Previously on We Live Here.
I have been turned down numerous times only because I have an eviction on my record. One eviction on my record for an apartment. That was not my fault. I had nothing to do with it.
Hey guys, it's me, Tim.
And me, Camille.
And today's episode is an update show.
Yeah, we're bringing you the next chapter in a story we first told you about a few months back, that of Latasha Johnson, a St. Louis woman who decided to challenge a landlord who kicked her out of her home after she complained and withheld rent over a collapsed bathroom ceiling.
Latasha's fight wound its way through the courts, all the way up to the Missouri Supreme Court. And it's a gripping journey, one you can hear in our episode called Housing Defenders, for those of you who are behind on your listening.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Courts can move slow.
Like real slow.
And the Supreme Court isn't in the habit of signaling when it's going to rule on something, which is why probably a lot of people were caught off guard when, over a quiet holiday break this summer, the Supreme Court finally did respond to Latasha's case.
I was meeting with some clients, and my staff got the email, and they sent a copy to me.
I was off. I was in East St. Louis over at the horse track. I'd taken off to, like, go do the horse hooky thing.
The two guys you just heard are the lawyers in this case. The first voice is longtime property lawyer Randall Ranker. He represented Koner Properties, Latasha's landlord.
And that last voice you heard is Lee Camp, a young upstart lawyer who was on Latasha's side.
Like, the first race and stuff was about to go off at 1 o'clock, and looked out at my phone, and there's the email from the Supreme Court that the opinion came out.
The opinion has been years in the making.
It had the potential to settle a huge question about how and when renters in Missouri are allowed to challenge landlords over the habitability of their homes.
And both Lee and Randall, and the rest of us, have spent the past 18 months waiting for the justices to decide here in Missouri.
Well, I was pretty excited. Mm-hmm. I mean, it would have been a lot less exciting if I'd lost.
They said, hey, get this circulated, you know, take a look at it. It looks like we have some good and bad that's just been handed down to us and everything, but we need to digest it.
Digest. That's what we're going to do with you guys today.
Because while, yes, the headline from the case could be summed up with simply who won Randall's side and who lost Ms. Johnson's side, but there's so much more to get into here.
A lot of the issues didn't get addressed. And it is not unusual, I think, for the Supreme Court to narrow their view or their ruling as opposed to addressing all of the facts.
On today's episode, we'll set out to do that, address the stuff the verdict didn't, and try to figure out the next chapter in this long battle over renters' rights in Missouri.
From St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here, a show for people somewhere on the woke spectrum.
So, this verdict that housing and legal advocates have been waiting for began with the case about a common landlord-tenant dispute.
At least, that's what Randall, the attorney for Koner Properties, thought when he first got it.
Well, it's a typical case. Mm. Tenant's not paying the rent. There is some complaints about the unit, but you know, they're still staying there and they're not paying.
Randall, who's practiced law for 3 decades, was brought in to fix the issue.
And it's very difficult to explain to your client, wait a minute. Here's my contract. Here's what it says is supposed to happen. They didn't do what they were supposed to do. How come I'm not getting what my contract says?
He sued to have the tenant, Latasha Johnson, evicted in early 2015.
Now, it's not easy sometimes being the landlord's attorney because everyone thinks, oh, gee, the landlord must be bad for some reason. And they're not. They've made an investment. They want to provide decent housing. And their reputation's important to them because if your reputation is poor, you're not going to attract the quality tenants that you want.
In the beginning, at least, it seemed like the relationship between Randall's client and Latasha was going to be fine. But then Latasha started making complaints about the condition of her apartment, which was in a tiny northwest town in St. Louis County.
It got to the point where 1 month she withheld her rent, thinking it would prompt Koner Properties to act. And it did, but not in the way she expected. Here's a little bit of Latasha telling her story to us in that first episode, which is again called Housing Defenders. Go back and listen to that whole episode if you haven't already.
The first time something went wrong was actually in November of 2014. And I had let them know that, hey, you know, the floors are starting to, one of the floors are starting to crumble up. And they said, well, you know, that has nothing to do with us. Maybe that already had been there, or they gave me some type of excuse as the reason why they didn't want to fix it. I said, okay, well, you know, I'm in this thing here, and so I can't, you know, really, you know, do much about it now because it's only a little bit. So, you know, I did what I could and, you know, tried to work around it. The second time, I think I complained about the stove not working, and they came out to fix the stove. The third time, there was water that was leaking.
That winter, Latasha says things got worse. The bathroom leak concerned Latasha, as did the mold she began to see on the walls. In management's fix, caulking around her upstairs neighbor's tub didn't stop the water.
Latasha withheld her rent in March 2015, hoping it would prompt some action. It didn't. And 2 weeks into the month, disaster happened.
And then it became more dripping, until one day, the whole ceiling just caved in. Well, half the ceiling just caved in. And I called them at 3 o'clock in the morning, and they didn't show up until 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning to come out and look at it. You know, and I actually called the emergency number, and a guy actually called me back and said, hey, what's the problem? I said, my ceiling just caved in. And he said, well, there's nothing that we can do right now.
Even when management and maintenance officials did arrive to Latasha's apartment, they didn't have an inspiring solution. Instead of fixing the hole, they covered it up.
They put a trash bag over it to stop the water from coming through. But the problem is that the trash bag was so full of water till it stank. It literally was a worm coming out of the freaking wall. I tried to reason with them and say, okay, well, you know what? If you allow me to break the lease, if we can break this lease, you pay me back my deposit, I can go about my way, you can go about your way. They didn't want to do it like that. They tried to give me they tried to send me over to a different apartment building, but that apartment building also had molding in too, so it wouldn't make no sense for me moving from one apartment to the other apartment. Then they tried to say, well, you know what, we can try to fix up on it while you're here, and you can just use a different restroom and still stay into your apartment, but go to a different apartment building whenever you need to use the restroom. Well, that wasn't going to work for me either. So I finally ended up having to just move out. And I became, after standing in hotels on top of hotels, after standing in shelters on top of shelters, and going back to hotels, I finally ended up being homeless on the street.
It took us a while to get Randall into our studios. He declined our initial interview request to talk about this case, which was filed by Legal Services of Eastern Missouri.
What had began as a simple eviction hearing had morphed into a 3-year legal battle that made its way to the state's highest court.
But I suspect that Legal Services was probably looking for a test case to take it to the Supreme Court to test King versus Moorhead. Mm-hmm. King versus Moorhead was the underlying case that was discussed in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And I would say virtually every judge in the state since then has been following that, and with the requirement that if you're a tenant and if you're going to complain about it not being livable, then you have two choices. You either move because it's unlivable, or two, you're going to have to escrow your rent money into the court registry so that the landlord's got something to hold on to in case they win.
What Randall is talking about is a concept that's at the core of this case. It's what all of it boils down to. It's something called the implied warranty of habitability. And basically what that means is If you rent some place to live, your landlord, it's implied that they guarantee that that place you're living in is actually livable.
And in Missouri, tenants have been told that before you can sue your landlord to say, hey, that's not happening, you have to give over your rent money to the courts to hold in like an escrow account. But this was never actually written into law. It was kind of like a strong tradition. A strong tradition that usually worked when landlord attorneys brought it up in court against people they wanted to evict.
And Latasha's attorney, Lee Camp, and other tenant advocates say that's not fair.
You know, even if you're not a poor person, it could still be difficult depending on, you know, how much you're paying for rent to live in your home. If something really goes wrong, to be able to get out of that situation. And that's been the status quo for 50 years. And as of July 3rd, that has changed.
Well, kind of. See, when the Missouri Supreme Court issued its ruling this summer, it did hand Randall's side a victory.
It agreed with the original lower circuit court ruling that said that Latasha should have paid her rent into an escrow account and against an appeals court that reversed that ruling.
But the Missouri Supreme Court also set out that going forward, it'll be up to trial courts to determine on a case-by-case basis whether it's appropriate for a tenant to have to set aside money in order to claim their landlord hasn't provided a livable space.
That is a great silver lining of this whole thing, a marked change where we're going to now have an additional procedural step when someone says, my home is not safe, that just hasn't existed in Missouri for essentially 50 years.
So now, this fight will continue right where it began, in the lower courts. But there is one person who may be left out of it.
You know, tenants are going to have additional rights, and are going to have some new access to the courts, potentially, that they didn't have before. That doesn't change Ms. Johnson's situation here. Mm-hmm. And all the good that she has done for probably tens of thousands of people in Missouri, it doesn't necessarily improve her situation. It doesn't take away the fact that she's got an eviction on her record. It doesn't take away the fact that she was homeless as a result of this, mm-hmm. and continues to still have difficulty finding housing in this area, as a result of trying to just hold her landlord accountable, which is something that she's now paved the way for other people to be able to do, which is fantastic. But I don't want to let the focus fall off of Ms. Johnson. You know, she was courageous through this.
It's been 3 years.
It's been 3 years.
Yeah.
It's been 3 years of her life going through this and waiting.
We didn't get a chance to talk to Latasha again. Lisa, she's still processing this ruling.
She was understandably upset. Hardworking. She's scrappy. Yeah. She doesn't intend to fall behind on rent. She didn't in this case. She withheld her rent. That's clear from this opinion. I do appreciate that they point out she wasn't just late. I mean, she literally withheld her rent because of the conditions in this home. She was attempting to hold her landlord 100% accountable for not delivering a safe and habitable home. And, you know, as a matter of law, the court doesn't rule on that, if that house was safe or any of those things. It looks at this procedural piece, but arguably, if Ms. Johnson was to come into my office today, post this ruling, I would be able to proceed and say, here's the things we're going to get together to present to the court, and we're still going to move forward with this implied warranty of habitability claim. And, you know, if the court rules against you in this way, here's the different things we're going to do to abate that or to mitigate it, or here's what you need to be prepared to do. It does allow me to counsel someone like Ms. Johnson better on the front end. But again, it's all someone other than Ms. Johnson. Yeah. It's not her today, and she still deals with the realities of this.
So what's next? Turns out, a whole lot.
Because though the verdict in Latasha's case has settled her situation, it's caused Lee, Randall, and other housing attorneys to prep for the next battle.
When the Missouri Supreme Court put out its ruling in Latasha Johnson's case, it said that it was ultimately up to lower courts to decide whether or not they were going to make a tenant pay rent to the court in order to challenge whether or not the place they were renting is actually livable.
And you may be thinking, didn't judges always have some discretion?
Kinda.
Yeah. But now, the Supreme Court has made it clear that the process can't just be rubber stamped, so to speak.
And tenant advocates like Lee hope that means renters will at least get a fairer shot.
One thing we're going to have to do is we're going to have to go to court and teach judges, you know, what this process should look like.
The way Lee would like it to work is this.
If a tenant wanted to challenge a landlord, they could ask a judge for a special hearing that would decide whether or not the tenant would have to pay rent into the court in order to bring that legal challenge before the court. So basically, they get a chance to make their case about whether or not they need to pay rent into escrow to challenge a landlord.
But there's no guarantee that landlord attorneys won't do the same thing. Remember, they've already used a version of this tactic successfully for decades.
That's where I've got to be a better tenant advocate outside of just representing my clients and go to the community and empower people to know how that this isn't an absolute requirement. They may ask for it, but you absolutely have a right now to say, Judge, let me be heard on this issue. Let me tell you why it's hard for me to do this, and let me tell you what I've been doing to try to change that, and how long this has been going on with this landlord, and how we've been trying to work things out, but it's just not working on actually getting these problems fixed with my home.
So that's one road this whole legal argument could go down. But the other side is ready to carve out its own legal path forward.
Well, I can only assume that there will be some judges out there who will decide, well, it's my discretion. I'm not going to make them do that. My job to represent my clients is to stay away from those judges, because if my client doesn't have the ability then to collect their money, because what's lost in this is that the vast majority of cases we file, getting the money after the judgment has taken place is not an easy task. If someone develops a reputation of inhabitability case that they're not going to require the escrow, then we're going to do our best to stay away from those judges, because, and I'll quote without naming a judge who told me years ago, he says, if you feel like a particular judge has a particular persuasion or bias, it's almost malpractice not to avoid them.
Attorneys like Lee, those fighting for the Latashas of the world, say this case is a symptom of a larger issue in Missouri and across the country,
where the quality, affordability, and access to housing can be linked directly to who you are, what you look like, and how much money you have.
Like, low-income people don't need more barriers along the way to getting into court and having their day. There's already a myriad of those that exist, implicitly and explicitly. And so, we want to make sure that we protect those rights moving forward. There's just an imbalance in these powers that's not even close right now between a landlord and a tenant.
That's not exactly how Randall sees it.
In this case, if she had the money, which I suspect she didn't have the money, what difference does it make if she's paying her rent to the landlord or paying into the court registry? It doesn't make any difference.
The lower court said it. Part of their decision was that it would make a difference, because if she is without, you know, sort of the means that perhaps the two of us have, that if you're paying rent into a court, that limits your ability to go out and find more suitable housing if there's a legitimate issue. What do you make of that?
Well, that ignores what practically happens, is that people who have real habitability issues, they take their money, they save it, and then they go find another place. It really isn't part of your question, but the other frustrating part of what I see is when someone has children and they claim, oh, I've got dangerous conditions in my apartment. Well, I don't really care if I had the money or not. If I really thought my kids were in danger, I'd find some other place to take them so that they were safe.
But the argument on the other side is that when you're in a situation like you just described, that if you're essentially having to pay double rent to bring your challenge, you have to pay it into a court, and then you'd have to theoretically have the money to go out and secure another housing option, and you don't have the means to do that, then what do you do?
Well, I would disagree with your characterization that it's double rent.
Okay.
Because if you have a legitimate habitability claim and you've sent a letter to the landlord saying, look, I've got this situation that makes my apartment unlivable. And let's think for a moment, what's that really mean? Does that mean that the toilet doesn't work right? I don't think so. I think it's got to be a serious issue that you can't live there. Mm-hmm. You send them a letter saying, look, I'm moving out. You save your money. You go find another place to live, and you're really not doubling up.
But in that scenario that you just laid out, that means breaking a lease often. And that comes with its own penalties, correct?
Well,
more often than not with your clients.
It could. However, when my clients come to me and they say, hey, here's this tenant, and they wrote us a letter last month, and they said that the shower fell in, and there's mold everywhere, and they're leaving, and you know what? They owe us 2 months worth of rent. My advice is that's not a path you want to go down, and they don't.
Mm-hmm. But, okay. I mean, it does strike me that if you're in a situation where you have X number of dollars to your name and you have a serious issue with a place you're renting, that it is especially burdensome on you in that situation if you have to pay rent into a court to bring your challenge. And then in the scenario that you laid out, now do that, break a lease, pay whatever fee. I mean, I'm not saying your clients are doing this. I'm not here to judge your clients. I'm just talking about a hypothetical that you know, I'm sure very well is possible. That in this situation, you're going to have to pay rent into a court. You're going to have to get, you're going to have to break a lease. That'll probably come with a fee. And then assuming you have any money left to cover all of those costs, lay down a security deposit and find another place to rent. That, I mean, wouldn't that scenario be especially burdensome on the people with the least in our community?
Well, and your focus is entirely on the tenant. It's not about what's fair for both sides. The other part of that is that if, in fact, they are successful, i.e. they did have a habitability claim, mm-hmm. none of that money that they paid in the court registry is going to go
to that assumes that they have the money to begin with to follow all these steps that you laid out.
Well, I don't know why they wouldn't have the money in the first place, because they would have had to have paid it each month. And my perception is they just don't have the money and they're not paying it.
But if they're paying into a court, then they do have the money. They're just paying it into a court, right?
Correct.
And even if they were successful in their challenge, they would have to stay in an uninhabitable place.
I don't agree with that. If they're successful and the court rules that it's uninhabitable, mm-hmm. they will let them out of their lease. They will return to them all the money that's in the court registry.
Mm-hmm. Well, then they would also have to stay in a place, to your point about people with children, that would be unsafe during that period.
That's possible.
Do you think that there are issues of race and class involved in this particular case?
No, not at all. I find that to be puzzling, because the only color my clients are concerned about is the green. I recognize that in days gone by that there were issues involving discrimination, but as far as I can tell, my clients are not going to turn away. They want two things: somebody who's going to behave and somebody who's going to pay their rent on time. Other than that, it makes no difference to them who they are.
Realtors and landlords are pretty powerful in this state, and you know, the fight's going to continue, and we're going to be standing right there alongside the next 50 Miss Johnsons that come in our door and try to make sure that their rights are adequately secured in the court, and that they actually get their due process and a true day in court now, moving forward, especially in regards to these safe and sanitary housing, to make sure that individuals do get to hold their landlords accountable through this new mechanism that the court has outlined for us.
The day before we released this episode to you, Tim and I got an email from Lee.
It gives us an update on the case and Ms. Johnson's current situation, and we're going to just read you some of it. Here it goes. Quote, "We have filed a motion for reconsideration in the Missouri Supreme Court on Ms. Johnson's behalf. This is a motion that essentially asks the court to re-examine its decision based on a flaw. We have filed it at her request to try and get the decision not requiring escrow payments in habitability cases to apply to her case and get a rehearing in the trial court below. It's our last legal shot for her at this point.
Lee went on to write, as you're aware, she's been homeless for the better part of the summer and is trying to find stable housing. We continue to do everything we can to assist her in finding housing. But the fact remains that significant barriers of poverty and having an eviction on her record continue to loom over her hunt for housing.
And that's the end of the email from Lee. And when we talked to him just a little bit ago on the phone and asked him about this motion for reconsideration, he said at this point it's probably a legal long shot.
Next time on We Live Here.
It was like a movement. It was like a movement.
What he did,
that's what it was.
Yeah, because what he did, he tapped into every African American attorney and asked them to come on board and side with them to get this thing going.
We Live Here is produced by me, Tim Lloyd.
And me, Camille Stanley.
Alana Sistrunk is our associate producer.
And Robert Peterson is our boss. He's the director of radio programming here at St. Louis Public Radio.
And from St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.